uses criminal prohibitions to ban certain activities. And I'll give you a sense of what some of those are in a bit. So this law is enacted, and in addition to that law, we have provincial laws, relevant provincial laws also that come into play. So this piece of legislation, as it's being debated, as it's being enacted, just the media, and I don't know if you guys remember this, but there was so much in the news about stem cells, right? About whether we should be allowing stem cell research, about human cloning. Anytime it was brought up, it was massively controversial. And I love to give this example about how controversial it was. So I was doing an interview with a reporter in from the Canadian Press. He's from Toronto. He's phoned me to talk to me about gene patents. Has anyone heard this story before? So I apologize. But they tell it all the time. So you see, I'm doing this story about gene patents. And at the end of the conversation, I thought it was off the record. So I just start chit-chatting about the new law that's coming into place. And I make some comments that I thought were totally off the record, just chatting with friends. The next morning, I wake up. And the banner headline of the Edmonton Journal was, U of A prof supports human cloning. It was the banner headline. And I'm like, oh my God, who is this guy? Oh my God, it's me. And it was a huge story. It was one of those stories that was so big on the back, it continued, and it became an investigative story. And they started interviewing colleagues of mine, Glenn Greiner. Does anyone know Glenn Greiner? Yeah. So Glenn was quoted in the back, I know Tim, he's not crazy. That was the pullout quote. So, but I tell that story because it's very relevant to, it illustrates sort of the climate, right, that was during the time that our law was enacted. And that unfolded right before the law. And if you look what the parliamentary debates were going on, these kinds of discussions permeated the parliamentary debates, right? So what does the law say? The law criminally prohibits reproductive cloning of any, well, actually, I'll put it this way. It prohibits human cloning of any kind. It's a criminal offense. You can't use a cloning technique, and we'll come to that in a bit, to do anything in Canada, whether it's reproductive or research. The law also criminally, and this is like 5 to 10 years in jail. Like, it's a big deal, right? So I don't know who goes to jail, whether it's the postdocs or who goes, but someone from the lab's going to jail if you do this. It also bans the buying and selling of gametes, of eggs and sperm, buying and selling of embryos. It has some prohibitions that are also criminal in nature around surrogacy. It bans something called germline interventions. Have you heard of that before? So this is the idea of any intervention you do to the human body that you might pass on to a next generation. That is viewed as a criminal offense in Canada. And it has some other prohibitions. Now, what's interesting is this law was really created to regulate IVF clinics, by and large. That was the starting point, but it very much became about these prohibitions. Move forward a few years, Quebec brings a Supreme Court challenge to this law. Why do they do that? Because they say, this isn't your jurisdiction, feds. This is our jurisdiction. This is a health issue. Health is a provincial jurisdiction. So they challenge it. Now, the challenge is very, very complicated. The Supreme Court made this decision just a couple years ago. And they did strike down a lot of it. They struck down all the stuff that related to the IVF clinics, but they kept the prohibitions I just talked about. Very complicated decision. But they did strike down some of it. But I'll come back to why it's important. So we have these kind of, we have this law in place. And as that law was being debated, I was fascinated. We actually done research on this, on how people reacted to all the topics on reproductive technologies. So the three topics I'd like to bring up, and there's a fourth one if we have time, are the following ones. Human cloning, and I love this topic because everyone thinks intuitively, of course we should ban human cloning. So I'd like to talk about, you know, should we really have a criminal ban on human cloning? The other one I'd like to bring up is the buying and selling of human eggs. This is happening a lot in Canada. Thousands of women are going to the U.S. to buy eggs, and some of them are going to the U.S. to sell their eggs, from anywhere from $5,000 to $50,000. You are a blonde Caucasian medical student from Harvard,
you have a good chance of getting $50,000 for your eggs. In Canada, that would be a criminal offense. The last topic I'd like to bring up, and it's a very, very current, hot topic. In fact, there was a story that came out in Nature today on this point, or maybe it was yesterday. And this is using prenatal diagnosis. Now, prenatal diagnosis has been around for a long time. But did you know that very likely in the near future, in fact, they've already done this, some scientists are questioning the degree and the accuracy of which this was really done, but I have no doubt they'll be able to do this in the future. They will be able to take a pregnant woman's blood, and from that, so non-invasive, from that blood, reconstruct the entire genome of the fetus and sequence it. We're talking near future. In fact, I'm involved in a research project that we just submitted on this very topic. So in other words, from a blood sample from the mom, so that does away with a lot of the concerns about prenatal diagnosis, right? The fact that, you know, you might be hurting the embryo. You take a blood sample, you can reconstruct the entire genome, and you'll know the color of the hair, the color of the eyes, and a variety of other traits associated with that embryo. What do we do with that information? Obviously, you're going to know the sex, too, right? And so how do we regulate that? So those are the three things I'd like to talk about. So let me warm you up, because I know I want to hear what you guys have to say. Let me be provocative and warm you up with respect to cloning. So cloning, topic again, I've been very, very close to really from the start, really became famous the world over as a result of Dolly. 1997, Dolly is created. Now, Dolly, you could argue, is the single most famous animal maybe ever that actually lived, right? I'm talking about not Lassie or something like that. But can you think of another animal as famous, Secretariat maybe, that as famous as Dolly? When you say Dolly the sheep, everyone knows who it is, right? Why was Dolly... Oh, by the way, do you know why Dolly's called Dolly? Because everyone in the room knows who Dolly the sheep is, right? Okay. Why is Dolly called Dolly? So this would be the one thing you remember from this talk. So the way that you clone is you... And why Dolly was so famous is you take a cell from an adult cell. You take that cell, you take out the nucleus from that cell, you get an egg, you take the nucleus out of that egg and put the nucleus from the adult that you just took from, put it in that egg, and now that egg has a full complement of chromosomes, right? Because we have an adult nucleus now. It thinks it's an embryo and starts behaving like an embryo and starts dividing. And if you're able to, you take the embryo, you put it into a woman to gestate it, and if you're lucky, and this is not easy to do, you will have a offspring that is a near identical, not completely identical, near identical genetic copy of the individual that you got the cell from. Now, why is it only near identical? Any scientists in the room?
There's no mitochondria.
Exactly right. Exactly. Everyone here, there's no mitochondrial DNA. We get some of our DNA from the egg, right? From the mitochondria. So it's not near identical, but pretty identical. So that's Dolly was the first time they did that with a mammal. And back to why she's called Dolly, they got the cell to do that from the mammary glands. So she's named after Dolly Parton. Seriously. Clever scientist. As I said, the only thing you remember from this talk. Who's Dolly Parton? So Dolly really created a shockwave around the world. And again, very close to it, so I really sense this going on. Governments immediately started talking about we've got to ban this, and they went straight from Dolly, and Dolly was done for research purposes, to the cloning of human beings. Right? They went straight from that. Governments all over the world, UNESCO, United Nations, OECD, World Health Organization, everyone moved on making suggestions around this. Right? And that was all heightened, all that kind of rhetoric was heightened by groups like the Raelians. Do you guys remember the Raelians? This was a free love cult from Quebec. Free love and cloning, weird combo. They decided that they were going to get complete fraud, scientific fraud, to get a notoriety for themselves by claiming to have cloned the first human beings that they named Eve. And again, this was all playing out right when our law was being enacted. So not surprisingly, we have that criminal ban in our legislation. Now, so what I'd like to do is maybe look real quickly at the arguments for, you know, I'm going to be provocative here, but how many people in the room think we should have a ban against reproductive cloning? I'm going to leave that whole research purposes aside.
Human
reproductive cloning. Who thinks we should have a criminal ban to stop it? Okay. Don't know. How many people think, go for it, what the heck? Everyone can clone if they want to. As long as it's safe. Okay? And everyone else is sort of in the middle? Okay, well, let's go through this. So one of the fascinating things, I start my class every year with this question. I always start with cloning. And I've really noticed a change in the students. First, all the students said, for sure, ban. And there has been almost a social accommodation to the idea of cloning. So what are the arguments against human cloning? Why has there been a ban? First reason, and this is sort of amorphous thing that drives me nuts, is it's against human dignity. To allow the cloning of another human being is against human dignity. It somehow infringes the dignity of both the source and the clone. Now that is tied up in the idea that the clone is genetically identical. Now, is that in itself a good justification? There are clones walking around all over the place, right? What are they?
Twins.
Exactly, identical twins. Are they an affront to human dignity? Those twins, are they? I've met some there, but... You know, it's funny because you Google identical twins and you get the Olsen twins, and then you go, maybe it is an affront to dignity.
What are those guys on Facebook? Twins.
Are they twins?
Yeah. They're on Facebook.
You sound like you're more informed on the Facebook universe than I am, so I'll leave that for So the idea is the mere fact of genetic identical somehow an affront to human dignity? And I don't think that stands scrutiny. Okay, we can talk about that. The second thing is, are they really genetically identical? What would be a clone if you could do it successfully? And really what they would be is twins separated in time, right? And they'd be less identical than identical twins because they'd have a different in utero environment. They'd have different, which we know has a huge impact. They'd be raised differently, right? They'd eat different food. They'd have a different environment in general. So they would be less identical than identical twins, reproductive clones. So I'm not sure just the whole idea of who we are is tied up in our genes. And so unless you buy in wholesale to the idea of genetic determinism, which I don't, and I don't think most people do, it's unclear to me how that can be an affront to human dignity just because they're genetically similar. The other argument you hear is, and this is a fascinating one, maybe with a little more teeth to it, is that, and this is the one that the Bill Clinton's bioethics committee bought into, is that you would be putting unreasonable expectations on the clone. You would be having, you know, you clone Michael Jordan, right, and you're going to expect to have a superstar basketball player, and you're going to put all these expectations on the clone. But does that really stand up to scrutiny either? I don't think so. Parents have kids for crazy reasons, right? Mostly because they made a mistake, but a lot of people have kids for labor, right? They have kids with, you know, really high expectations, right? They have very specific... In addition to that, parents already put crazy expectations on their kids. They're going to be the next Sidney Crosby. You're going to be the next, you know, Yo-Yo Ma. Those expectations already exist. And this was also a critique of IVF babies. I don't know if you remember that. When IVF first came in, people, one of the arguments against IVF is parents are investing all this money. They're going to put all this huge expectation on these kids. It seems unfair. Right? That has not played out, and the evidence, empirical evidence, says to the contrary, that doesn't happen. So I'm not really sure, under scrutiny, whether that holds up. The other one, this is a serious one that was raised a lot, early days, not so much anymore. And in fact, the Department of Defense in Canada did a whole report on this very topic, and they actually called for an international ban related to this topic. And this is the fear that, for example, countries would use cloning to create armies. We need a ban to stop cloned armies, right? Seriously, this was an argument against banning it. Completely rational if you think about it. So if you're going to have a cloned army, and they brought up Saddam Hussein back then, and he, let's say Saddam wanted to do this, he would have to have an army of women, right? You have to enslave an army of women to gestate the cloned armies, right? Then you'd have your clones, and then you'd have to enslave them from childhood till they became your super soldiers, right? And then you'd have to force them to be army, you know, to be in the army. Now, if you had a society that allowed all that to happen, cloning is the least of your worries, right? Absolutely the least of your worries. So again, I don't buy that as an argument for a ban against human cloning. The other one that we hear a lot, and the one with the most teeth, and I already mentioned it, is what? Safety, right? It is unclear. Cloning is very, very, very difficult to do. You know, cloning a primate, they still are struggling to do that with monkeys. They actually want to do that for research purposes. It's not easy. And when they do clone, it's unclear about the health of the clone. So that's the easy out for regulators. But we already have regulatory mechanisms to stop that. We have research ethics boards. We have the regulation of the medical profession generally. We have the right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So is it clear that we need, in a liberal democracy, a criminal ban on this topic? To me, it's not. The other thing is, there may be, you know, if you think about how cloning might be used, it forces you to question, you know, do we really need to ban this? So how might it be used in sort of a socially acceptable way? Couples that are infertile might want to use the cloning technology. Cloning technology may be able to help gay and lesbian couples have kids. Is that reprehensible? Is that wrong? But to be honest with you, I don't think, and this is, it also goes to this idea of the pressing need for a ban, I don't think many people would actually want to use this technology. People are going to reproduce the fun way, and if not the fun way, there's a lot of other technologies that they might be able to use. And also, and I think this is important, remember, despite all, there's been years and years of arguing around this and very high-level discussion, and despite that, no one on planet Earth since 1997 has tried to clone a human being. Absolutely no one. So I ask you, again, what you guys think, and whether you think that Canada should have a criminal ban on reproductive cloning. So I look forward to your comments. I hope people have questions, comments, opinions. I am trying to be a little provocative. See what you think. Now, one thing is, if you do a survey, and the numbers have come down a little bit, but if you do a survey on this, most people will say they think there should be a ban on reproductive cloning. Why do you think that is? What do you think the gut reaction is? Anyone?
For me, it's because it's not a natural process. It's a clinical process. It's going against nature, in my mind. The example you cited with identical twins, they happen naturally. They're not in a lab. And so, I think that is the distinction I'm making.
So she said that it's not natural. But that can't be the argument. I mean, we hear it a lot. You hear it a lot, for sure. And I hear it. Sure. But curing diabetes is not natural. Curing cancer is not natural. Heart transplant, not natural. Kidney transplantation, not natural. All forms of IVF, not natural. Birth control, not natural. Condoms, not natural. You could go down the list, right? Now, I do think there's this really intuitive yuck reaction to cloning, for sure, and that's the reason, one of the reasons I picked it, right? Because, but the idea that it's not natural, remember, what we're talking about is using the justifications for a criminal ban, right, in a liberal democracy, which is the biggest hammer we got. I'm not sure, not natural. Now, listen, most people would agree with you, so I'm just trying to, yeah?
This is just a question. When you talk about identical twins or triplets or whatever, that's clone, right? Those are clones, technically.
They're clones because they're, if the definition of a clone is there are genetically, so are identical twins clones? They are clones because they're genetically identical.
Okay.
And more so than a clone using the Dolly technique.
Exactly. So the type of cloning you're talking about, where you're taking body cells and combining them with gametes, that type of cloning, how is that? It's also called cloning.
Yeah.
How are they differentiated? I mean, I know how they're different, but in the language, how are they differentiated?
Well, you know, I think that's a more important point than you probably realize, because when cloning was, people regret using the term cloning and associating it with Dolly, right? More so in the context of research cloning. So one of the reasons this exploded, this whole topic exploded, is because it happened at the exact same time as stem cells. So what scientists want to do at that point, not so much anymore, but they wanted to be able to, let's say you had diabetes, someone had diabetes, they wanted to be able to take a cell from you, put it in an egg, create an embryo, and remember these are not, you know, these are very early stage embryos, extract a cell line, and now we have a cell line that's genetically identical to whoever we got it from. We grow a pancreatic islet that has your DNA, put it in you, and you don't reject it, right? So that was called therapeutic cloning, and scientists were kicking themselves for using the term cloning, because it brought it, and they could not shed it. They tried to think of somatic cell nuclear transfer, SN, you know, tried to relabel it. It's like the liberation fear, you know, treatment, that whole controversy, the MS liberation treatment. They're trying to shed the term liberation treatment, but they can't, right? It's stuck with it. And the same thing happened with that. So I think when people talk about cloning now, the term of art refers to the Dolly technique. That's what I think that it's used for, and it's both in scientific literature and to a large degree in pop culture literature. So that Dolly technique is used both for the research cloning and also for the alleged reproductive cloning. Now they have cloned pigs and rabbits and cats and cows and horses and monkeys, but as I said, primates are really difficult to do. I don't think they've done many primates. And it's really a technological achievement to do it, because it's very difficult. It sounds like a simple process, but it's very difficult. Other comments? Yeah.
Are you going to go to that?
Okay. Thanks a lot. This is just my kind of uninformed response as a non-scientist, because as a non-scientist, the issues you're raising for me are kind of redefined as political and legal issues for the most part. But in a sense, I'm making a comparison in my own mind between not simply cloning, but the general issues of reproductive technologies with the use, shall we say, of nuclear energy. Because nuclear energy, as we all know, can be used for dehumanizing, destructive, and devastating purposes, building a bomb. But it also has a tremendous number of positive potential as well. And I would assume, having no theological or political axe to grind, that the same can be said of reproductive technologies. And in a sense, the genie is out of the bottle. And once that knowledge has already been produced and assimilated, it never can really be put back into the bottle. So for me, the issue is trying to, in a sense, distinguish, and I'm not sure if this is even possible, but nuclear scientists seem to think it is for their area, trying to distinguish between the destructive versus the positive uses of reproductive technology. And some of the examples you've given, a gay couple cloning for purposes of childbirth, seems to me eminently reasonable and desirable under any human rights regime. Cloning individual parts of the human body, I could see, has huge implications for medical research and helping people live healthier and maybe longer lives. On the other hand, there are some aspects of reproductive technology that I would find really offensive, sex selection being one of them, even though it could be argued that in saying that I'm violating the rights and sentiments of particular communities and heritages. But but I would argue that any country which is a signatory to the United Declaration, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, can be held accountable to prevent sex selection, because it implies that the life of a woman is of less value.
Not in Canada. The selection, okay. They choose women over men in Canada. Did you know that?
I didn't. That's another reason to change that law from my perspective. But in summary, what I'm saying is there a model or a paradigm, maybe the use of nuclear energy, that would help us to put together a way of distinguishing the productive for the positive from the negative uses of reproductive technology? That's the root of
the it's an excellent point, and I think the scientific community has tried to do that. You know, they really have tried to use that exact example. Because you know what was always raised, and if you go to the parliamentary debates, it's easy to find, is slippery slope arguments, which, you know, as a legal scholar, we hate those arguments. They're almost a non-argument, right? Because you think of what, we can't allow reproductive cloning because it's a slippery slope. I mean, we can't allow research cloning because it's a slippery slope to reproductive cloning. Which is the argument, so with the scientists said, well, if you take that argument, we should ban physics, right? Or we should ban physics. And in fact, you should ban all animal research because that's where we're going to perfect reproductive cloning. We're not going to do it with humans. We're going to perfect it. So ban all that. So if you buy the slippery slope argument, you know, where do you draw the line? So yeah, I agree with you. I think there are models. But you know, for my provocative talk today, I think we even need to explore, you know, what is the harm at the end of that slippery slope that we're trying to avoid? Is it really, really clear from a liberal perspective of a liberal democracy whether we need to ban it? Maybe we should just regulate it, as you point out.
That's a good point. No, I agree with you. Thank you.
First of all, pardon my being late. I have reasons which I'll explain later. But I missed the first part of your presentation. And as usual, I agree with my friend Tony over there. In fact, I was going to say very similar things. First of all, I'm reading a book on plutocrats and the division about the 1% and the 0.001%. It's by a young lady who's from Peace River, Alberta, where I spent many, many years. And so I'm fascinated by what's going on and about the increasing division between the 1% and or actually it's the 0.001% and everybody else, and that's growing. So when you were talking about, you know, cloning the elite, the superstars, that to me is very problematic. A, because of course it's a question of elitism and access. And I missed the first part. I don't know the cost of these things, but I assume it's going to be very, very costly. So who's going to have first access to all this? Of course, there are now presently 29.6 millionaires in the world. 29.6 million millionaires in the world right now, and it's ever increasing. So who's going to have first access to this? It's going to be the highly wealthy. And so therefore, the division, not only in the United States, but all over the world, between the upper wealthy people and the other people is going to grow dramatically. But not only that, they'll have access to the genes, to the talent. And that's scary. All of that's scary. Of course, on the other hand, then you can, for the sake of mankind, you can reproduce Einstein, you know, a gazillion times, and all the other superstars. But that's going to throw off all sports, all Nobel Prizes, all that kind of stuff, because of it's elitist. It's like Armstrong, you know, a gazillion times over. So obviously mankind is going to be bettered by it. But when you started to talk about the military, the first image that came to mind was the Nazis and the Übermensch. They had the women. Hitler was such a hypnotizer that he had the whole population convinced that they should do essentially what he was saying, which is create the Übermensch. You know, their people deserve it. And so I could see that happening again. I could see all these women wanting to make these beautiful, talented superstars who have all the genes. To me, that's not out of the question. You know, 100, 115, who knows when from now. So, and creating the army from that, I think that's also potentially possible, because for the same reason that the Third Reich came into being, was so effective. So I think all that stuff has to be looked at before we, you know, so I'm still on the fence, but I think, you know, it has great potential, but also very serious possible consequences.
I I'm sensitive to all of those issues, right? But you can make the same arguments with IVF, right? With in vitro fertilization in general. So I heard two things, and the access one I have a huge amount of sympathy for and intuitively completely agree with you. But the problem is, do you use criminal bans to redress that problem? We don't do that in other aspects of the healthcare system, right? Is that the right mechanism? In other words, what we should probably do is, if that's the problem, then create access. Like, create access in a just manner, right, in response to that. But the other one I think is fascinating, this idea about creating super. Because I really do not believe in this sort of deterministic idea of genes. But without a doubt, when you're talking about superficial traits, like height, etc., who are we kidding? That's genetic, right? The amount of quick twitch muscles you have in your legs, and that's genetic. So who we can, for sure you're more likely to get, and that's the whole reason scientists want to do it, right? So they can create disease models with animals, you know, genes are. So you're absolutely right about that. You're going to be more likely to get, if you want a Michael Jordan or Usain Bolt, you're more likely to get one if you clone Usain Bolt. But how many people have kids here? I've got four. None of them do anything I want them to, right? None of them. Okay, my son would kill me for saying this, but my advice, one kid, he's 6'2". I'm a huge track and field fanatic. It was my whole life. And if I could have cloned a track star, I would have. And you know what? I got my son, Adam. He's like, if he lived in Soviet Russia, they would have sent him off to Siberia to train as a runner, right? He's built so perfectly to be a runner. Does he have any interest in it whatsoever? Zero. Right? So it's a very complicated story, right? You know, I don't know. I just don't really think that cloning is going to lead directly to that.
Part A, about banning, you know, legal banning. What was the term you used? The hammer is called.
Yeah, the biggest hammer we have in a liberal democracy is our criminal prohibitions.
Right? Yeah, but the problem is, what about the totalitarian states, the ones that exist now and the ones that are going to exist in the future? And so this is not a national debate. This is an international debate, because if all the good guys opt out and say, oh, no, we can't go there because of X, Y, and Z, what about when a little country, in Africa, for example, or something, decides, yes, and we're going to raise this army, and we're going to have, 20,000 Einsteins, you know. So to me, this kind of debate has to take place in a Clinton thing, but eventually at the UN.
And the UN has tackled this, the idea of reproductive cloning.
And it has to have international sanction, criminalization, because otherwise, very difficult things will arise. And the other one about, having children and then not following the path you want. But, the other argument about genes is very strong as well, that genes do have a very deterministic effect on people's, I would say, not just bodies, but also minds. And therefore, the superstars will be, superstars. And those people, incidentally, will pull ahead exponentially from the rest of us in terms of financially as well. Because it takes a little bit too much to describe, but that's very much described in that book.
And there was a I'm blanking on his name. There's a scholar from Michigan who argues if we let this play out logically, we may have start to have different divisions in actual biological makeup. So the wealthy will be actually biologically different. Yeah. The arguments against that, and epigenetics to say this, is that you require a huge amount of time, like 20,000 years to allow that kind of division to start to occur. Actual kind of speciation between, huge amount of time. No?
It doesn't have to be speciation.
That's true. Right. I just wanted to back up this fellow a little bit, because you keep saying in a liberal democracy. I keep wondering why you keep putting that on, since, as he says, it's international. But also you keep seeming to assume that we live in a democracy. I mean, that's very questionable. And it's very questionable that we will go on living in anything which even resembles a democracy. So, I mean, when you start talking about these things, you can't just sort of tie your justification to a particular social system, which happens to be marginally in existence right now. I mean, it could very well be change in 10 years.
So you think, I mean, it's an interesting point, but you think we should create our laws using our liberal democratic system to create laws in anticipation of the society we're living in becoming possibly a totalitarian regime, and therefore we should have our so maybe I mean you could think
No. Don't try to force me into a vast generality, Tim. I'm just saying when you come across things which are going to have a lot of repercussions way down the road, and rather unpredictable repercussions way down the road, then you have to start being careful. And because it's like these people who say, well, there's nothing wrong with
GMO.
Atomic energy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we can store that stuff away and be happy with it and all this sort of thing. But that stuff stays in existence for thousands of years. You don't know what's going to be around in 1,000 years' time. I mean, so you don't know what the eventual repercussions of that are going to be.
Well, I'm not going to defend nuclear energy.
No, I didn't.
But I mean, we have to approach in some level, because to a large degree, this was a science fiction debate. It was a science fiction debate. No one's cloning. Very difficult to clone. There's no desire to do it. And this, we're talking like 2 decades now. If anything, the interest levels has gone down in the ability to do this. So do we create a law based on, you know, this sort of constructed reality? And to a large degree, this reality, and we've written about this, was constructed by, in Canada anyway, the individuals that wanted to avoid stem cell research because they were concerned about the moral status of the embryo. So talking about reproductive cloning became a proxy to talking about abortion politics in Canada. And we see that division in the legislative debate, right? Those who favored stem cell research, didn't bring up reproductive cloning. Those who were concerned about the moral status of the embryo brought up this, to my mind, a largely science fiction-based rationale.
Yeah, but the thing is that with reproductive cloning, right? I mean, we're not talking about the research cloning, right?
Yeah. Well, they banned both in Canada. Both are.
Well, I thought we were just talking about a ban on reproductive. Okay, that's all I'm talking about. The benefits of it seem to me to be so small.
I agree.
Really there's not much of a case for trying this out.
I agree.
Right? And, I mean, if there were some huge benefit to be gained by it, well, then, yeah, I'd consider it. But if you ban it now, it doesn't mean that if down the road we discover, there would be some huge benefit to allow some people under some circumstances to engage in reproductive cloning. Well, we can change the law to allow some exceptions. It seems to me the good place to start is the ban.
You start with the ban?
Yeah, and wait until you see some justification for it.
So anytime we have a technology we're uncertain about, we ban it and wait for how do you research to find out if the justification is going to emerge?
He's talking about reproductive.
Yeah, same. No, talking
I'm
about reproductive.
Trying to make a big long joke.
My turn. I find this really interesting altogether. It's interesting just what you said. Do we just ban the first new thing that comes along? I think, shouldn't we allow some sort of research, like strictly on animals then to begin with, and have regulations for them and let them begin the research first before we go and jump headlong into these, predicting a future we haven't even seen that's appeared in science fiction. And it's just scary to think that if the first thing that comes along that may be beneficial to us is banned, then we'll never know if we've found the cure for something, if we don't even allow the research of it. And I just find it's crazy to think that banning it is the first step and not, you know, instead allowing scientists to research it, but give them regulations, very strict guidelines as to what they can and can't do, and then further see, okay, so these are the results of this person's research, so therefore we'll go further there. Where do we regulate from then on? Not to just ban outright. I'm good.
Yeah, I mean, that is a great point. When these bans first started emerging around the world, there became a big community who wrote about it in the context of scientific freedom and academic freedom, right? And ironically, they had to flip, saying that this is what totalitarian regimes do to science. The whole reason we have academic freedom is to guard against, you know, people imposing their... and if we banned, if the state banned every kind of research that people felt uncomfortable about, we wouldn't have scientific freedom, right? I mean, that's the whole point of scientific freedom. So this became, and there's a group that still lives on as a result. I believe it's centered in Italy that still lives on, you know, fighting this fight. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a really important point that you raise.
Well, the thing that concerns me is what if we're in a situation where we find that it's necessary to be better, to evolve better, and to be smarter, and so on. It seems that we could quite easily come to that situation in this world that we live in.
Yeah, you know, so I agree with you completely that the you know, if I'm taking off my being provocative hat, I don't care if they ban it, because I actually think that the benefits are very, very small. There's other ways that they can address these reproductive issues instead of reproductive cloning. But for the same reason, I think I cannot believe we've spent so much policy energy talking about this largely scientific science fiction proposal that I truly believe is a proxy for other political agenda. But I also believe, on the other side of it, that so you have like this hype about the harms. I think this hype's about the benefits too. I think it would be very difficult to use reproductive cloning in any kind of way to really address the kind of things that you've been suggesting. Having said that, scientists have said exactly what you've said. Look, we should be able to do this. We don't know what kind of benefits we may get in the future, so don't ban us. Don't ban us now. It is interesting that it's important to note how closely linked reproductive and research cloning are, and we've been talking about separating for our discussion. But Canada is very interesting because it's one of the only sort of only jurisdiction that doesn't sort of have a cultural or sort of historical justification for the ban. The countries that ban it, surprisingly, the United States doesn't. You can get, so we're talking about cloning broadly, right? You can get money in California from Arnold Schwarzenegger's fund, which is a very interesting pop culture connection there, to do cloning, right? So you can get money from the California government, will pay you and encourages you to do therapeutic cloning, right? To do cloning experiments. You can get money to. If you do that exact same experiment in Alberta, you go to jail. Can you think of a nut? So other places you can do UK, Sweden, Japan, China, India, Belgium. I could go down the list of countries that allow this kind of research, but not Canada. So when I talk about this around the world, people are always astounded because they think of Canada as sort of a progressive, liberal society. So they're quite surprised of it. But can you think of another human activity? Name another human activity where there's that kind of disconnect. Alberta bans it. You go to jail. 5 years in jail. California, the government will pay you to do it. Can you think of another human activity? And I love this example because it really shows how these societies are struggling with these issues, right? When you have two such culturally similar jurisdictions with completely opposed approaches to it. Can you think of an activity?
Nuclear energy.
Nuclear energy?
Yeah.
You know what? I have asked this question a million times and no one's raised nuclear energy, and that would be a good example because in some jurisdictions it's not allowed, right? Is there a country where it's banned?
You can use the same argument for it indirectly.
If it
was banned in Iran immediately after the 1979 revolution, the Ayatollah Khomeini abolished the nuclear program.
Well, that's ironic now, right?
Funded through the Shah. That's changed.
But is there any because this is interesting, it might be a great example. Are there any jurisdictions where it's banned?
New Zealand?
Is it banned in New Zealand?
Including nuclear ships.
Yeah? Port. Yeah. So there would be that. I've asked this question for 10 years, and no one's raised this to audience. Everyone brings up prostitution. Well, the government doesn't pay you to go to a prostitute, right? Drugs, capital punishment. You hear those kind of things, but it's not the same thing, right? But here you'd have, that is a good example. You can get money to do nuclear research here, and I assume New Zealand would be banned. Great example. Thank you.
So can we not draw some implications from that vis-a-vis the reproductive thing? In other words, if a nation does succeed in doing it, will the others bounce on it and destroy it? Or will two or three nations join it and say, we will now hold the trigger, the rest of you can't do it, much as we're doing with nuclear energy?
Well, and in some ways it would be, if you think it's a problem, worse than nuclear energy, right? Because it's much more mobile. If you were a couple and you wanted to do it, you could go fly to, let's say New Zealand is the place where they do reproductive cloning, fly to New Zealand, get your clone, come home, right? So it would even be more of a challenge. So, I think there are parallels there, but I don't know where it takes us from a regulatory point of view.
I'm asking, can we see parallels in terms of the instituting the regulations or pretending to institute them? Why do we ban nuclear weapons? If Iran were allowed to have the bomb, they could join the club that has it and ban everybody else. Why do they not do it? Because the people who are banning it are the ones who have the bomb.
See, but then we're back to the analyzing whether we need to ban reproductive cloning. Is it such a grave harm that we have to take that level of level of action?
We only need to ban things that others have which we want. Otherwise, we wouldn't. So we haven't risen to the level where we say, I can do or send something wrong, but I will not do it. We aren't able to do that yet. We haven't reached that level of human development.
Maybe we could clone people to that level. What do you think?
if it's possible, they'll hide them.
Thank you. May I say something? So many points are being raised. Very interesting points. Very profound ideas, actually. Let me just say a few things. Why not ban the catch and the rye, just in case you read the book and you become corrupt? Why not be like the Minority Report, catch the criminals before they actually commit a crime? Why not indeed? What does that do to our freedom? Are we basically a human race for freedom, or are we basically a human race to be suppressive and or oppressive? Those are some of my thoughts. But from a psychological perspective, and I'm glad that you raised this point, that you have found out, just like I have found out, because they didn't send us to school for parenting, you see. So I found out by my own experience that, in fact, being a parent is a difficult job, and we do have this tendency to idealize our children, which you have come to understand is an impossible job to carry on if you idealize your children. How do we come to idealize our children? As a matter of fact, when I was an infant, I used to idealize my parents. I won't go into the details, but it seems that as a human being, we go through those phases. First, I idealize my parents. Then I begin to idealize myself. It's called narcissism in extreme forms.
Or teenagers.
Exactly. Then as a parent, when I go a little older, I start to idealize my children. And I also find that to be impossible. And if I was any smarter, I would then try to shed all of those idealizations. The problem at hand about cloning is really one of many matters at hand, one of many controversies, one of many conflicts. How do these conflicts arise? Well, why do I idealize? Because I wish everything to be perfect. Cloning is a wish to be perfect. But in order to me to adjust my thinking and come to acceptance of this wish that perhaps I cannot accomplish, I need to come away with a mature acceptance of who I am and all my limitations versus this unstoppable wish to be perfect. What happens in this interim, in this conflict, I have certain fears that I may fail. I may have certain fears that I go the other way around. I just read a news article about this pastor in the United States. Apparently, he came away from jail, and the congregation decided to hire him as a pastor on the basis that he's come to know God and has changed his ways. He had in his history a murder, a rape, of three other women before he went to jail.
Now that he's out of jail, they decide to hire him because he's changed his ways. Only recently to find out that he just murdered the girl next door, the woman next door, who is the daughter of a woman that he's about to marry, part of his congregation, and is now arrested. Why am I bringing this up? We have certain fears that we may not accomplish. We also have certain fears that I can be destructive versus being constructive. So I begin to project that which I can do to destroy, the other guy can also do. And part of all of these discussions, details aside, when we talk about banning, who should do the banning? Who should decide? Who's the power? If I'm in the club, I'm in a nuclear club, what would I wish? I don't want anybody else to have it, you see, so I ban the other guys from having it. On the other hand, if I'm not in a club, what do I wish? Well, I wish it's not banned so that I can have the chance to develop it, and so on and so on. I think all of these discussions has to do with the basic human insecurity of having these basic conflicts of all at once trying to be ideal and realizing that we have the potential to be at fault, or you can say that perhaps it's a basic fault to all humankind. One more point I want to address. Whether it's nuclear power or whether it's a handful of sand on the beach that became silicon and silicon and then Silicon Valley and then computers, we human beings actually have not created anything. Cloning is not creativity in its pure sense, at least not in a creation sense that we come to believe in God. We as human beings have only managed to observe and then describe science. And up to this point, whether it's nuclear power, computers, or cloning, that's all we've been doing. All of these things were there to begin with. The DNA was not developed by me. The DNA was only discovered, described by Watson and Crick through some x-rays. And then the human genome develops. We're just too stupid to know it all from the beginning. It's not new. The genome has always been there. So why are we in a hurry to try and jump the next step? And how are we going to handle it? I think ultimately our fears have to do with whose power would be at will and who's going to control whom, who calls the shots, and who gets to dance.
I think that you raise a number of really interesting points. One of them is this idea of social angst, and I've said that already. I really believe, and studied this for a while, that the whole cloning debate was a proxy for broad social angst about the role of science in our lives. But you raise a very interesting point about the idea of the seeking for the ideal. And this has been raised also by some other people. And this is the idea that there immediately when DALL-E was created, you heard people saying that people are going to use this to create ideal humans or try to perfect themselves or for narcissistic reasons, right? Well, they said the same thing about IVF, you know, that people are going to use it for those reasons, and they didn't really find that play out. Well, IVF isn't exactly the same because now we have cloning, and you can really start picking, choosing traits. They've also made the argument against prenatal diagnosis, that we should not allow prenatal diagnosis because people can start choosing their traits and give their kids an advantage. It's that, you know, quick example. They allegedly found the IQ gene. This was in, I'm going to say, 2001. And I got calls from people who wanted to do prenatal diagnosis to find out if the fetus they were carrying had the IQ gene, which is ridiculous, right? IQ intelligence is a social construct, you know, and it was not an IQ gene. It was a gene that predicted how fast a mouse could get through a maze, which is far from an IQ gene, right? And they're never going to find an IQ gene. But it goes to a very important point, because this is one of the arguments, strongest arguments that you hear over and over again, why we should ban cloning. And again, it raises, and I'm putting it sound like a law professor, really very interesting questions. When does the state jump in to say, you can't do that to your kid because it gives you an advantage? Right? So I can guarantee to you that sending your kid to a good university is a greater advantage than cloning a smart kid. So should we ban? Have this, you know, ban that idea there, or giving any kind of, giving your kids music lessons. That's a huge advantage. Most Canadians can't afford that. Should we ban music lessons? This is one that drives me nuts. Do you know there's this sort of like a, it's an arms race going on with primarily with boys, but with girls too, with holding them back in school. You heard this?
Yeah.
It drives me nuts. Right? Parents hold their kids back almost often as much as a year. So now boys are a year older than they're supposed to be in school, and now they're holding them back more, so it's like an arms race, and pretty soon the first year, you know, grade one kids are going to be 22 years old, right? give them confidence so they can get through. And it's, again, should that be banned? Right? They're just trying to give an advantage to their kids. So if I think cloning is, it's a, there's a note here that there's no evidence that the technology is going to give anyone any advantages. I just think that we're just not there to have these kinds of debates about. It's, we're debating about science fiction. Certainly not at the point where legislation should roll in and being provocative.
Picking up a theme but extending it, the question of who makes the decisions. Would I trust myself, for example, to make the decision that another Michael Jackson should be cloned?
And he's allegedly trying to do it, clone himself. He was before he died. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't trust him either. Yeah. I don't trust myself to do this. I don't trust anybody else to do it. Maybe, maybe my mistrust is so deep that I think nobody should do it, which is more or less where we are. A second point, if I may, this may be a bit of an extension of the topic, but we do get into the question of genetic modification. And I think to myself, are we ready to create a race of Roundup-ready human beings? And if so, are we prepared to let the Monsanto company have our rights on genetic modification?
You're always trying to advertise for Monsanto.
Well, I was going to use GMOs as, instead of nuclear energy as the example, right? This idea of, you know, when should we ban a technology or a regulated technology on, because it is a great example, right? Because there's just another report on this. There's no evidence. Because, you know, the bill that's going on in California right now, you know, the on Tuesday is that they're going to decide whether you have to have mandatory labeling. There's no evidence, no stitch of evidence that GMOs cause any harm, right, to physically to people. And there's been study after study. The National Academy of Science has said this, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, there's not a single person that's ever gotten sick from a GMO through evidence. There's any people die from organic food all the time, hundreds of them, right? But is it really about something else, right? Is it really about corporate control of our foods, stock, you know, and about the environment, right? So it gets, all of these things get entwined, and I think that's what's happened with reproductive cloning. It's really not about the harms associated with reproductive cloning, but about science more broadly and how we regulate science more broadly.
See, I don't know how to, I'm going to put all these diverse threads together, but I'd like to pick up on distrust in general and narcissism and megalomania a la Hussein and science fiction.
Yeah,
but here's what's going on in my head anyhow. I'm into a science fiction movie, and it's kind of like one of those James Bond movies where this gazillionaire has gotten control of X, and James Bond has to go in and do the rescue, or otherwise the world is going to go off the cliffs. Okay, well, my starting point is, guess how many billionaires there are in the world today? Just guess. Okay, don't guess. It's a put on. There are well over 1,200 billionaires, and it's rising like this, especially in the BRIC countries, which means that it's not inconceivable whatsoever. And these guys are in a culture and a world all unto themselves. They meet at all these watering holes. They have these conferences. They live in these apartments way up in the air. They have about five different homes. And it's completely other. You could call it almost a nation state a la way back, you know, in Italy before Italy. You know, it's definitely a different zone. We don't really understand what's going on in that zone. Very few of us have access to that zone. And there are a lot of crazy people a la Hughes in that zone, or could get crazy because they're so isolated and get whatever they need. So it's not at all inconceivable that one of these types, oh, by the way, they don't all have 1 billion. Many of them have lots of billions. It's true. So it's not inconceivable at all that one of these characters could get one of these island countries in the South Pacific and set up essentially their own nation state because they own everything, right? And they have laws unto themselves. Now, this kind of technology is not as expensive as nuclear technology at all. They could get the labs, they could buy all the profs, all the scientists, all the technocrats, and they could do this for themselves for several reasons. One, they're more narcissistic and more egomaniac than any of us. That's the, well, that's according to my reading thus far. They're not, you know, okay. Two, they might need a child, and they would combine it. They would combine cloning with genetic engineering. So they'd have somebody coming up that is the superstar runner, but it looks like me, talks like me, but it's, you know, modified, so it's even better. Let me finish the thought. So to me, the regulation for this, because it, to me it is possible within the next 50 years, has to be at the international level. And when? That's a huge question. The young lady over there behind, you know, was saying, you know, we could dawdle along about this, but the more I think about it, the more I think, what's to stop one of these kind of characters from doing this? And talk about the genie out of the bottle. You know, once it happens, and Tony, other Tony's about, you know, once somebody has it, then the other billionaire's going to want it. There's going to be like 1,600 billionaires out there, and they tend to be very status-oriented, right? So that's what I'm thinking about, the genie out of the bottle a la billionaires.
Yeah, so I respond to that as, who cares? Knock yourself out. Clone yourself. why do you care? Like, why, what's the harm? So they clone themselves, and I'll tell you, if you're worried about, like, having, like, a, you know, given this super race, you know, super genes and stuff, like, I'll tell you, the advantages they can give that kid from their billions of dollars far outweigh any kind of genetic advantage. And also, the kid's going to be so screwed up that he's probably not going to... I mean,
parents.
I mean, there's so many factors that, that have an impact on how they play out. And it, but think about this, and I love raising this because it raises the yuck factor, right? We talk about you cloning body parts, right? Which is a possibility. This is a real, you know... This, you know, I work very, very closely with the stem cell community. This kind of whole thing has fallen off of the radar as a research method with the product, introduction of iPS cells, induced pluripotent stem cells. At Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize just a couple weeks ago on this from Japan. This is the idea that you can take a cell from your body, genetically modify it. I know you guys don't like that term, but just kidding. genetically modify it, and you trick it into thinking it's a stem cell. And so it's kind of done away with the need for... the therapeutic cloning. But think about this. What if these millionaires, like the billionaires, multi-billionaires, they want to clone their body parts, right? Save them. So that's okay, right? We're okay with that. Clone some islets, right? So they can have, if they have diabetes, maybe clone a kidney, and so that way we can solve the shortage of kidneys, which is a grave concern, right? Clone livers. Probably guess where I'm going with this. Why not just clone a headless body? So we all have a clone headless body that we can draw parts from. We're born. When we're born, we create a clone headless body. It doesn't sound right. I don't know exactly why that shouldn't be allowed. But you know what I mean?
I do. I have,
it's a great question. I ask my classes all the time. And it's one of those yuck factors. This doesn't sound right. You know, but that's the kind of, you know, thing that pushes the...
Just a moment. We have somebody here. Okay, I'll come back to you.
Okay.
You get your chance.
So I want to take the financial aspect to sort of on a different vein here. So you had mentioned liberal democracy a couple of times, and it was brought up, and sort of what that means in terms we have the choice and why not, and the fact that it's banned criminally. So there's a couple of points to that. The first being, it tends to be that in a liberal democracy, when you begin with, when you begin with something like cloning, well, a lot of that is brought up, about by different companies that end up wanting to pay universities and whatnot to research. Okay, so that's the first part. But then what happens, because there are consumers that are available potentially for whatever sorts of things, including the public. But then what happens is you get the individuals within that society also wanting to have the freedom to make this choice. And therefore, they want their governments to end up paying for these things. So, but the problem becomes is that and this is a trend, and I think you know well, that we put so much money into the cure that we no longer have the funds for care. So palliative care goes to the wayside, all sorts of those kinds of things. So what are our priorities? Because this individual choice that you speak of becomes a public choice necessarily. And then the second part of that, very quickly, is that you have a criminal code ban because we don't any longer recognize anything moral. You can't just say you shouldn't do this. So what other sort of way can we say that this is not the right thing to do? There is no such thing as moral good anymore in a liberal democratic society as such.
Wow, great stuff. And so the first point about I, as you probably can guess, I completely agree with you. In fact, we have a research project on this very point, and I think it's exactly how it plays out. You know, create this sexy new technology, and you can think of it: the cancer treatments, the PSA testing, mammograms. You can go on and on. They create this need. Right, and then people want to be able to choose it, even if the same scientist that created it said, you know what, you don't need that. People still want access to it, right? And so we have actually a research project, and a component of it is to explore what role does sort of public preference play in a health system in deciding what technology should be used. Do we do it all on evidence, like PSA, mammograms, those kinds of things, or do we do it based strictly on evidence? Yeah, and I completely agree with you about the care thing. You know what makes you healthy? You do five things. You probably know I was going to say this. Five things. And everything else is almost useless for the five things. Don't smoke. Exercise vigorously. Eat lots of fruits and vegetables. Try to keep your weight down. That's a tough one. And basic prevention. Wear a helmet and seatbelt. Everything else.
What about having loved ones around?
Yes, love, sleep. So I have this next tier: sleep, loved ones, and standing is also emerging as a really important. Not sitting too much, but everything else, right? So it goes to this whole idea of a economy that tries to produce these sexy technologies that consumers are going to want, and our society is going to pay for. And if they don't pay for them, there's an uprising, right? There's an uprising around it. Do you know there's a study that just came out that said that going to see your doctor?
Yeah.
Did you see this? Useless. It may be harmful. Yeah. So you have the primary care doctor. You know, how often you push, you know, it's Movember right now. Go check your doctor. I want to be careful because they, there's no evidence at all to support that may be harmful.
What about psychiatrists?
We need to...
Very harmful.
We need to take a break in a few minutes, so this will be the last one for this section.
Well, I think I lost my point anyway. But what I was trying to get at, this is really a discussion about science. What can science do and what it couldn't do? And I think you either buy into the myth of science, which says eventually we'll fix everything, or you go back one step and say, you know, what's the good, for example, of prolonging somebody's life that has cancer? Maybe you want to make sure that they don't suffer, they die peacefully, but what's the point of extending a life for 15, 20 years, that wasn't meant to be there because we got cancer? Or even better, why don't we address the possible causes of cancer that are brought about by overcrowding, pollution, money, whatever, all right? And this, I don't know if it's really a question, it's more a wondering. You know, as long as we believe the science, because they can do it, it will do it. or as long as we believe, for example, we still believe in academics, there is no academics left. It's money. Okay? And so money drives the research. And then research produces more money that is going back and driving some more research. To make our life better? In what way? You know, if you look at a number of people with juvenile diabetics, it's an epidemic. If you look at the people with allergy to peanuts, you know, when I was a kid, we used to pay to see a kid with allergy to peanuts. Now you can find them by large numbers, right? So my wondering is this a product of the way we live? Is this a product of the environment? Is it the product of genetic engineered crops? You said we have no evidence. Well, we have no evidence either way. And then you can go one step further and say, you know, who, and the question has been brought up before, why should we stop playing roulette, if you want, with genes and decide that we know better than the chance system? You know, to me, it doesn't make any sense, because then you have to go back and decide, who is the one that's going to make the decision, which again has been brought up before.
I mean, to your last point, nature can be cruel, right? And so we have decided, I think, that we don't let nature just run its course. We try to cure diseases. Well, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should just let people die. But what I mean that is, I mean, you cure kids. We cure, you know, people that are in car accidents. We do a lot of things where we just don't let nature take its course. But you know, to your broader point, I agree with you that there's often far too much of an app. You know, I'm very involved in stem cell research. It's incredibly expensive, and a lot of it's focused on type 2 diabetes. Right here, right, the Edmonton Protocol. What's the biggest cause of type 2 diabetes? Obesity, right? You know, but we do need to be careful about, you know, this is the health. This next generation, perhaps, and we're talking about kids. Up to this next generation, this is the healthiest the human race has ever been. The least amount of crime, the least amount of, you know, I have these friends that go, oh, kids these days. Well, you know what? It was way worse when you were a kid. Way more drunk driving, way more drugs, way more teen pregnancy, way more crime, way more smoking. You could go down the list. It's never been a better time to be a human being on planet Earth than right now. Not in every country, but certainly in Canada. Now, people think it's like this fictitious past that people see, like the farms that they live on with the little cows. It didn't exist. Right, and you know one of the most dangerous places to live? A farm. Most healthy place to live? Big city.
Can we break for 10 minutes? You can recharge your tea, and then we'll come back. Thanks.
Can I take this picture?
Why is their life this value? If it's just nature,
we also have these drugs on cash.
And, you know, because of the way we're put together, we are going to try to alter nature in the same nature as, you know, can alter things in the nature.
Now, I'm not saying, I'm not supporting Monsanto, which is, it's important.
The large dog will actually make accommodations so that there's a Absolutely.
2 minutes and we'll return to our common conversation.
But not everybody who smokes.
Well, shall we begin again? Shall we begin again? I will point out that if you see that Professor Caulfield is escorted out of here shortly, it will be because he is the first person, I trust none of the people serving us can hear this, the first person who has ever smuggled a coffee into Steeps.
I apologize. So I said that we were going to talk about three broad topics. And I wonder if we should move on to another topic unless people want to keep hammering at cloning, because I got a sense we could do this till 8 o'clock at night. But I want to move to the comment you made. I was going to leave sex selection.
Could I just make...
Oh, yeah, for sure. Please.
Sorry, I'll be so fast you won't even know I spoke. That's the God's truth. But you mentioned social angst. That pushed all my buttons, because God knows how many human insecurities I have. But one thing which just occurred to me, actually, and I'll make this brief, is that some people raised the prospect of some kind of fascistic cloned army kind of marching over the battlefields. And this is what I wanted to say about that in the United States military now, we know that the leading research funding is being pushed into robotics, that what they call autonomous weapons systems. And this is true for what we know of China and Russia as well. And this is true not just for drones and unmanned aerial vehicles, but for computerized bomb detection and disposal units for submarine submersibles and so on. And it looks to me as though the future battlefields, when they're fought out in the world, are increasingly going to be robotic, because the speed, the precision, and the information processing capacity of computers and robots is infinitely greater than any human being will ever have. Whether or not it's genetically engineered human being, I don't think there's any chance of them getting up to the likely level of robotic performance. Why am I saying all this? I just think that that if we're really talking in an anxious way about genetic engineering and cloning, it's worth remembering the amount of money, research money, which is going into robotics, because that's really the future of high performance, whether it's on the battlefield, whether it's automated robots in industrial places like that. And I guess I'm just concerned that so much angst over cloning will blind people, if you like, to where the real money is actually going, which is into military robotics.
I agree 100%. Great minds. Because when this gentleman was talking, that's the first thing that popped into my mind. If you're really worried about billionaires, you should be worried about them building a super robot to take over their island, because that's way more likely. It's way more likely. And the idea about, and this is one of the, it's what I've written about in this area, one of the things I've written about, is this idea of this amorphous social angst taking about a constructed reality taking over the policy domain. And policy, so it sounds like we agree, the policy energy where... It could be focused on this area more constructively, right? So in a more informed way, and B, on more important things, including public health and other topics like that. So I completely agree. But the amorphous angst thing, this is a real part of the story. It's not. There's something called the yuck factor. Have you heard of that? And this is relevant to the other things we're going to talk about. So the yuck factor, which is the wisdom of repugnance, and it's a real. Leon Cass in the U.S. is the most famous proponent of it. And it's a real school of thought. And there's a Canadian who's quite famous for it. And who it is? Margot Somerville. Have you heard of Margot Somerville?
Yeah.
She said the ethical canary. And that's the whole idea, is that we should follow our guts, and that that has real moral meaning. And of course, I think this is completely insane, right? We think that, you know, mixed marriages had a repugnance towards that, towards giving women the vote. We had repugnance towards that. We had repugnance towards sperm donation. We had repugnance. You can go down the list of things that we used to find repugnant that upon sort of rational reflection, we no longer. So it might be a starting point, but I don't think it should be a justification for regulatory policy. And that's exactly what Leon Cass was suggesting, is that we, you know. So it has a real part. It's a real part of the story. So should we launch into another topic?
Okay. Okay.
So I wasn't going to bring up sex selection, but I have a sense that this group might, I'm going to be provocative again, might enjoy this topic. And it's a really hot topic, right? And this is the idea that it's going to become increasingly easy to test, either to select the fetus beforehand, so you know what kind of sex you're getting, and that's the men's job, right? So the sperm, or you do prenatal diagnosis and you abort the child you don't want. The latter being right now the most scientifically viable and predictable. The former, through things like sperm sorting, you can just increase your chances, and some predict, you know, not even sure how much. So right now we're really talking about, in the foreseeable future, we're talking about aborting, using prenatal diagnosis to abort a fetus. This has got a lot of attention recently. The CMAJ, Canadian Medical Association Journal, recently had an editorial where it was suggested that doctors should not be allowed to tell patients the sex of their fetus until it was too late to abort. Do you guys remember that? CBC did a big thing on it. A lot of it is concern from, in Canada, about certain minority groups who have very strong views, cultural views, about the sex of their child. And that basically they want men, all right? They want boys. And that has led to this kind of claim. Now, in the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, it is a criminal offense to do an activity that will increase the chance of having a certain child unless it's done for medical reasons. Because as you probably know, sometimes there's medical reasons for sex selections. I think everyone agrees that's okay. But there is, in the law, you cannot use... Now, that the problem with the law is it would only apply to reproductive material. So it doesn't apply to prenatal diagnosis. People follow that? It would only apply to sperm sorting or some kind of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, something where there's reproductive material outside of a woman that would be done. That would be banned in Canada, other than for medical purposes. But in Canada, prenatal diagnosis for sex selection is allowed. Okay? Now, so have a criminal ban on women accessing the information, the sex of their fetus in order to stop sex selection? Now, some background facts. I already mentioned this in response to comments made already, that globally in Canada, Canadians favor, especially for the first child, girls. Right? I have two of each. I think they're making a mistake. Boys are easier to raise. Just kidding. But they do favor, did you guys know that? And even back in the 80s, when they were first doing research on this, that was the preference for girls in Canada. But there are these communities that would like to have this ban. I mean, sorry, that would like to favor boys, and so there's a strong push towards this ban. And when this was talked about publicly, you got the sense that most Canadians agreed with the idea that sex selection was wrong. But should the government have a law, should it be a criminal offense to do sex selection in Canada? So I'll ask that question now before I throw out all my provocative... What do people think? This gentleman clearly thinks that it should not be allowed. Sex selection. Yeah. You said ban on sex selection.
You're right. It violates the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
How?
Because it
by definition implies that the life of a female human being is less valuable than the life of a male.
What if they're selecting, what if it's a family, they got five boys, and they want a girl? And desperately want a girl, and the mom says, unless I get sex selection, I'm just going to abort.
Tony's a Catholic.
Hey, I'm as my grandmother said, the religion I once loved and will love again. My Irish grandmother. So maybe we're in the same camp. Fallen Catholics?
That's very comforting. I'll try and do the intellectual somersault, which will put us onto the same side here. But there are limits, I suppose, in my view, to the meaning of the term pro-choice. Because I tend to be pro-choice in terms of a woman's right to seek abortion, contraception, even a woman's right actually to wear a niqab or a full veil if she chooses to do that. But often I don't perceive it to be often a woman's choice for sex selection. It's often the expression of a patriarchal family system, which has always traditionally put much greater value on males than females. So maybe I see that as an expression of form of political oppression. But basically, the Declaration of Human Rights states categorically that all human beings should be, their value, their life should be of equal value. So
would you ban the selection of a girl?
Yeah.
I'm
opposed to sex selection of any sort.
So what if the outcome of having an unwanted child, instead of allowing sex selection, where maybe infanticide occurs or the infant is abused as a child, is the worst outcome from a human rights perspective than allowing a woman to use sex selection? And that is where cultural norms would really come into play. And of course there's the issue of you're telling a woman that she is not an autonomous entity and is incapable of making an autonomous choice.
I agree, that is an implication, but all rights have not only their own limitations, but all rights come into contradiction with other sets of rights. I mean, that's just an unfortunate complication of the society in which we live. There are no rights which are absolute. I mean, the old expression, my freedom of expression, doesn't give me the right to call out fire in a crowded cinema because people could be killed in the stampede getting out. And I think pro-choice, you know, is like that, that it doesn't...
In a country like Canada, though, if there's no evidence that globally there's a preference for... And the preference is very close, by the way. But the preference in Canada globally seems to be girls. And by... amongst the community there, where there's a fresh preference for... And I'm trying to be provocative, trying to force this.
Okay.
Where there's a preference for boys, if you ban it, it might cause more harm, not less, for an individual that's actually been born, that it has dignity and has rights. So, using a human rights perspective, the ban may actually heighten harm, not to identifiable humans, not lessen it.
I see the logic of your argument there. It still contradicts a very fundamental assumption on my part that it's making a value, a respective value of the value of life. I don't think the life of a female should be regarded as superior to the life of a male any more than I believe the reverse. So. But you're right, it's not an easy question to answer.
Hello? This family that's got five boys, if they wait a bit, they'll probably get some lovely granddaughters. Okay? That's one thing. Also, this discussion has come up before here. And at that point, we were told that the choice in China was for boys, in America for girls. And I can't think of a better way than getting peace in the world, you know? Okay, so that's...
Do it all.
And that brings us to another thing, that is, when do we decide that it's a human being? Okay. Tony is assuming that it's a human being from the beginning, right? But that's a good point for questioning it. Is it a human being, or is it just bunch of cells in the developing.
I'm not going to touch that one.
Tony is Irish, and so he can assume that. You are Italian, yeah. Now, so you must assume what you assume.
For a book project that I got my genome. I'm looking at you because you might find this interesting. I got my genome scanned, and as part of that, this is a complete aside. Well, it actually has a little bit of relevance. As part of that, I could find out where my heritage, where I am, what I am genetically, right? And I'm a big critic of what genetic risk information can really tell you. I think that phenomenon is limited. But the actual sort of genetic heritage is incredibly powerful, particularly for European descent, because they have so many samples to choose from. So I thought I was this, you know, hodgepodge of Europe and a little bit of Spanish even, and we actually thought that we were part Cherokee, to the point where we were thinking about getting status. So I get my genome scanned, and I go, it was at Stanford, and I go to find, I am 100% Irish. You could go to Ireland, and the geneticist said this, and test 100 people and not find anyone close. I don't have Scottish, I don't have Welsh, I don't have English, I am 100% Irish. Now, it's interesting because, being of good Irish heritage, we have a lot of offspring, not just personally, but our family. And my daughter, Allison, is the first female. So my dad had three boys back in Ireland, and back in Ireland, my all boys, like in some families, have eight boys. My daughter, Allison, is the first girl. So in that situation, you know, would it be appropriate for my wife to try, you know, sex selection in order to have the Caulfield family produce a girl? Now, of course, there might be paternity testing issues. I should probably find out, maybe. Fairly certain she's mine. I do travel a lot, but
is your wife 100%?
Just to complicate,
my wife is not 100% Irish. I've sullied the purity of our lineage.
Then we have a case for cloning. Yeah.
Just to complicate things a little further, you probably, I don't know, you should know that the Spanish Armada crashed on the shore of Ireland.
Yes, so. That was my father's.
Part of the Spanish Armada was all sorts of people from the Mediterranean area.
Yeah, that was my dad's belief, and he's wrong.
Well, what time?
So the other thing about this issue, and one that's often forgotten, and this comes up with the idea of telling doctors, it's just from an ethical perspective or a regulatory perspective, that they cannot do sex selection, right? That seems like a reasonable approach. Do you think about that? What that means is, from a legal perspective, that's problematic. How would you operationalize that? Right. So either you have a ban saying you can get an abortion in Canada, but you can't get one for sex selection. How would that play out? How could you possibly operationalize that? Right. Are you going to interrogate women as they come in to find out what their reason is? And incredibly difficult choice that you're making in life. And it's never going to be just one thing. It's the wrong time in my life to have a child, and I don't want a male. You know, it would be. So, is it only when it's the dominant reason, or if it's, what if it's just 25% of the reasons that you want to have an abortion? So you have that operational problem, right? So how would you ever operationalize it in a sort of a just society? And from a doctor's perspective, we have a right of access to our health information. So if you go and find out, you get an ultrasound, a woman can say, I want to know the rate. Yeah?
Just off the top of my head, you know, A, you could ask the young lady, do you know the sex of your child? And I know what you can say. And then B, say to her, before we do this, we'll have to give you a very high-tech lie detector test. So she says, you know, this is just off the top of my head because I don't know the state of the art of lie detector tests these days.
Not very good.
Okay, but that's, and also about, you know, abortion versus, the possibility, you see, of policing and punishing the unwanted born children. The abortion is irrevocable. Once the fetus is gone, it's gone. But one, theoretically, this is ideally speaking and theoretically, you could always ratchet up the policing and the punishment for ill treatment of the unborn. That's a sidebar point.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. And the other side of the argument is, look, we shouldn't ban sex selection. What we should do is encourage an egalitarian view of women. We should create a society and now, oh, that's a pipe dream, Tim. But no, it's not. I mean, we have that evolution has occurred, right? And so rather than banning that, you know, people have argued that's it destroy the need, right? The inappropriate need for sex selection for inappropriate cultural reasons, right? So that is a little bit of a pipe dream, but we have done that, right? To some degree. It takes a long time. There's another question. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. You know, Tim, you mentioned China indirectly and India, and I want to bring out that just a few blocks away from here, a few weeks ago, there was a celebration of the United Nations International Girl of the Child.
Your
Child of the Girl.
Day
of the Girl. And there was a film shown about mothers killing their babies because they were girls. I think we can all agree that this is unacceptable as we speak in today's world in human evolution. And so using the simple sentence, you know, to resolve conflicts using peaceful dialogue. We must have dialogue. This is urgent, and this type of dialogue should continue, I submit. And Tim, your comment on this, among the pockets of compassion, both local and global, so that we can prevent this kind of atrocity that still exists. Thank you.
Well, it sounds like you know this, and maybe we've even discussed this before, but the evidence, I think, is clear that in China and India in particular, there is this tremendous bias. And this bias is playing out in actual numbers. So while we can't, and it sounds like you've heard this, while we can't get exact numbers on how many both selective abortions are happening and how much infanticide is happening, it's happening because the numbers are not, you've heard this, right, not represented. So they raises very, now, I am trying to demonstrate, as you probably know, how difficult it is to make regulatory decisions in this area. But what would be worse, right? Allowing the selective abortion or the killing of the child that... Now, there are some that say there is no difference, right? They have that moral view, right? Others would say they're both terrible, but at least one doesn't lead to the killing of, you know, the murder of a born child. Very, very difficult decision. In a country like Canada, I think it becomes, in some respects, more complex and in some, but perhaps less urgent. It's more complex because we don't have that kind of clear policy issue at play, but at the same time, it's less, it's more complicated because we have this diversity, plurality of views in our society. So how's that for a lame lawyer answer to your great comment? There was another comment. Did you have one? No?
I'm just wondering if this discussion is limited to self-selection or selection for other things. There are so many things that can be selected at birth as opposed to, say, a doctor selecting or nurses selecting the birth or non-birth of a child based on what they can see. And then, of course, the parent's choice of selection in terms of problems with that child if it gets born.
Yeah, and that's why that's actually the context I wanted to raise in it, because if we could really do this whole genome... So you know what I mean by whole genome sequencing? Whole genome sequencing is going to be cheap in the very near future. So, you know, the Human Genome Project, billions of dollars to sequence, you know, one human genome. We're going to be able, everyone in this room could get their whole genome sequence. In other words, all the genetic material in your body done, I think, in the future for thousands of dollars and probably hundreds of dollars. It's going to become so cheap that some in the healthcare industry are suggesting that we should just have our sequence genome sequence at birth, and then it just becomes an issue of access as opposed to like what little bit of information are we going to get. If you can sequence, and there's no doubt this is going to happen. As I said, I'm part of a research grant right now. Fingers crossed it's successful. Where we're going to explore the issues of this non-invasive prenatal diagnosis, where they are going to be able to tell every single trait. Now, is it okay to abort a child if they have, if it turns out they're carrying Huntington's disease? 100% penetrant, all right? So if you have the HD gene present, you're going to get it. We don't know when you're going to get it. We don't know how it's going to manifest itself, but you're going to get it. Most people, yeah?
Excuse me, what is the disease? What does it look like? What's the symptoms?
Huntington's? Huntington's disease is a horrible neurological condition that kills you generally somewhere between 40 and I think 55 is the general parameters. It starts manifesting itself not unlike Parkinson's disease. We have rapid cognitive decline. Not a fun way to go. And if you have the gene, so that's why you find out when you're 20, you know you're going to get it. And it could come earlier. So most people feel comfortable. And there is other things like Tay-Sachs. It's another good example. Horrible neurological disease that kills kids very, very young. Or painful death. They live a short life. And most people say, you know what? It's probably aborting that. In that situation, it's probably okay. But you can see where the continuum goes. What about if the child has breast cancer, the breast cancer gene? Now, if you have the breast cancer gene, there's only somewhere between 6, depending on the studies, let's say 60% chance you're going to have breast cancer sometime in your life. Do people feel comfortable with aborting a child for that? Now, this has played out. Women have said, breast cancer has ravaged my family, and I do not want to put my child through this. So if my child, I want to find out if my child has a breast cancer gene, and if you won't let me do it, I'm just going to abort. What do you do? And this is the kind of, and as we have this information, we're going to be able to make these decisions more and more easily. And then we come back to what we talked about before. How would you ever operationalize it, right? You can have access to this information about your body, right? Because it's your body, but not this other information. Because we don't want you to make a bad decision based on it. Really, really tough regulatory challenge.
It also brings up the interesting question of what's good for the society as a whole. Could you imagine if genetic diseases that were not allowed to propagate, they could be eliminated from the gene pool?
That's right, and we're even seeing that starting to happen a little bit with Tay-Sachs, which is present in a particular community. And if you are aggressive about getting tested and actually who you marry, that reduces the chances of having a Tay-Sachs baby. So we have seen that happen. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Open question. Now, should we move on to another topic? We have like 15 minutes left, 20 minutes left. Is that a good idea? This is the other one I love. It's buying and selling of eggs. One of the reasons I love it is because, again, very, very controversial. How I like that. And also it's an issue that's happening right now. So you can go, as I said in the introduction, you go online and you can buy eggs in the United States. In Canada, that's banned. So women can sell their eggs in the United States up to $50,000 and even more for their eggs. And in addition to that, they can do that multiple times, right? Now, should know that it's not a completely non-invasive procedure. Women have to take certain drugs, and obviously it's not like sperm donation. It actually requires a medical procedure. And so there is some risk involved. Now, the risk is minimal. If you look at actual data on this, but the risk is real. And it also allows, goes back to the sort of eugenic idea, it also allows people to choose traits, right? So who are the, as I said earlier, implied earlier, who's selling their eggs? You know, Harvard medical students, blondes, tall, that's who's selling their eggs, right? And there's no regulation of it. Now, in Canada, it's banned. Now, I won't bore you with this very interesting legal questions about can Canadian women sell their eggs in the United States if they do it all, you know, sort of through the internet? Is it caught by the law? We need to talk about that. What do you guys think? Now, when I... Yeah, go ahead, Emily.
Just a question of clarification. Yeah. When you say this is who's selling their eggs, do you mean this is where the, what the market is wanting? Or is there something peculiar about these women that they're the ones who are selling their eggs?
That's a great question. In fact, it's both. Definitely the market wants that, right? So the arguments for banning are exploitation, right? That there's somehow the women are going to be exploited and that we shouldn't allow that to happen. The poor women are going to give up their eggs and the people are going to put themselves in danger, etc. Second reason is it's being banned is this idea of, again, sort of this amorphous, and I don't know if Rebecca talked about this, commodification idea, right? The idea that we're commodifying the body and this kind of thing should be absent commodification, these kinds of tissue should not be subject to the market. And those are really the two arguments, yeah?
Isn't there a long-term health risk if they do it too often?
Yes, there is a health risk for sure, and that's with something that, you know, to be considered. But so now I'll put on my always arguing against the arguments. There is data on exploitation. Erica Ames from Newcastle, where they actually allow some compensation for eggs. She actually studied who's it donating, and do they feel exploited? No, they don't. They have, on the contrary. The other interesting thing is there's been a shift of opinion in Canada. Now, this is one of the questions I always ask my students at the beginning of the year. 20 years ago, all the students said this should be banned. 10 years ago, still most said banned. Now, not a single woman in my class thinks it should be banned. In fact, they're enraged that they think the state can tell them what to do with their body. Right? I cannot believe that the government can tell me what I can do with my eggs. In fact, two years ago, a group of women in my class did a great presentation. I'm not sure I agreed with them, except that they did a fantastic, passionate presentation on this idea that the state should be able to regulate the buying and selling of their eggs. What do you guys think? Should Canadian women be able to sell their eggs? By the way, men can't sell their sperm either. It's turned out to be a little bit of a shortage of these reproductive material in Canada. That's one of the reasons that people are going to the States to get these eggs.
Yeah, I had a young lady,
years ago, I was a counselor in Peace River, Alberta, and I used to counsel this young lady when she was in, like, grade 3. And then later, she became an extremely talented actor. And she was going to go to a school in Scotland that was extremely expensive, but one of the best in the world. And she was desperate. She came to me as a young lady saying, what do I do? What do I do? Because the funds she could raise in Peace River were extremely limited over summer. So I facetiously suggested this. I said, you have this great talent. You know, you're an extraordinary lady, and by your donating these eggs, A, you'd be able to, you know, fund going to this prestigious school, and B, you'd be passing your talent around, you know, increasing your talent in the world. The only downside, I thought, at that point in time was what I had read about the possibility that if it's done too often or by an incompetent person, that there were health risks, and that she should research it and make her own decision, discuss it with her parents, all this kind of stuff. But I see, personally, not much yet against it.
Other comments? One of the interesting things when people are thinking about... Oh, you had a comment? No. One of the other interesting things while people are thinking of comments, in some countries, in the U.S. being one of them, we have this really... And the U.S. is such a crazy place to begin with. But we have this really strange paradox happening, where it's tightly regulated in the context of research. So if you're donating for research, in fact, I was just involved in a policy statement on this coming from the International Society for Stem Cell Research, where we argued, yeah, you should be able to compensate women for their time and the efforts of going and the risks they're taking in order to donate their eggs and compensate them quite significantly, not $50,000, but maybe $5,000, right? So we have that kind of regulation happening in the U.S. when you're donating for research, where people would think, well, this is really good for society, but in the context of reproduction, no regulation. Yeah.
The only thing, in retrospect, the only thing I have against it again is elitism. Because if the price is $50,000,
you know, then only the wealthy has access to these eggs for their children. And the middle class and less than middle class do not, and that's to me a big problem.
Well, some people have also argued from the exploitation point of view the opposite, that if you make it too low, only the rich kids aren't going to donate their eggs. Do you know what I mean? And Erica, you see what I mean? Because if it's $5,000, $5,000 means a lot more to someone who's impoverished than it does to. But Erica found that that wasn't happening. That the reasons people donate and the reason they sell their eggs are complex. Money is just one factor. And they do it for a whole bunch of reasons. They want to do it. She's an extraordinary. She's an anthropologist, does extraordinary work, and she was quite surprised at the degree to which the people did it for exactly the reason you said. They want to help people out, and money was just part of the story. Sometimes they've come from a big family, and they want to. But for sure, yeah.
Right here.
I just wanted to suggest that, looking us in the face, there is a uniquely Canadian solution to the problem. We're well familiar with marketing boards in Western Canada. So if they have an egg marketing board for chickens' eggs, why the hell couldn't we have a marketing board for human eggs?
You're absolutely right. A regulated market, right? Where if you have a regulated market, you could actually kind of do away with. People have made the same argument about organ donation, right? And this was a topic I would love to. We just did a survey. I was part of a team that did a survey. Maybe you saw this, get a lot of press, where we asked Canadians whether they think that you should be able to pay for organs in a regulated market, right? Most Canadians said yes. We were really surprised. As long as a regulated market. And the other interesting thing is that, now this is not proof of no exploitation, but it hints at it. The poor were less likely to donate as money went up than the rich. Like, in other words, the rich were like money. And it seemed like, do you know what I mean? So the richer you were, the more likely you were to donate based on money as compared to the poor. Isn't that interesting? Now, we could sort of dissect why that might be, because we just have survey data. We don't know why that is. But it hints that, it's not going to draw, exploit people that are desperate to come in. So a regulated market.
What makes me feel uncomfortable about this is that if it becomes widespread, it would seem to me then that there would be a lot of pressure on young women to in fact do it, right? Because unless you are fairly wealthy to begin with, $50,000 can make a hell of a lot of difference in your life. Can buy you a good education, and then you're competing with other young women who are doing this. They're getting the education. You don't have the money to do it. So you're putting pressure on women to actually engage in this practice, okay? And since it's a practice, what's wrong with the practice? I mean, that of course is the question. I mean, but it seems to me to be a major breach in our customary thinking how human reproduction should go on, and you're forcing people to, in effect, make that breach by opening up this market.
Yeah, you raise a couple of really interesting points. So the idea of the pressure thing, so a lot of this discussion was, again, related to stem cell research, because remember talking about somatic cell nuclear transfer, talking about using the Dolly technique in research purposes, you need eggs to do that. So some people said we should ban the Dolly technique because we don't want to create pressure on women to donate eggs for research purposes. Follow that? Right? So this was a big part of the discussion around the buying and selling of eggs. The pushback you get, and it's interesting because the feminist community, I'm not an expert on this literature by any stretch, but there was a very interesting tension happening there. Because on the one hand, they didn't like this whole idea of buying and selling of eggs. On the other hand, they didn't like the idea that the state controlling their body. And also, they didn't like the idea of the state telling them, you are so fragile, woman, that you can't make this autonomous choice, that you're subject to these social pressures, and therefore, women, we're going to make a law to stop this from happening, to protect you. So there are a lot of interesting issues to look at. Now, as we said actually before this even started, there's been this really interesting push away from those kind of speculative views of ethical issues towards this empirical analysis of ethical issues. Not a lot of people think that's a great idea because they think they're not giving enough weight to sort of conceptual analysis in this context, these kinds of contexts. But there is this push towards empirical analysis of the issues. So in other words, you say it causes harm to women, show me the data that this has caused harm to women. And that's why people like Erica Ames from Newcastle went out to try to find the data that hurts women. Now, some people don't like that because they say, you know, there's some things that we can never have data for, like the worth of autonomy and things like that. And if we go down this road, we're going to go too far, and every time we can't find empirical evidence to support harm, we're not going to do anything. Sorry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I mean, look, ethical values have a number of different foundations. I mean, the proscription against harming other people is just one of them. I mean, we have a, as you like to say, a yuck factor against harming people. I mean, but that's just one source of ethical values. I mean, you've got to look at the other sources of ethical values as well.
Well, how many people heard Ubaka when he was here? So Ubaka and I wrote a piece together on the commodification concern. And we looked at it a bunch of dimensions. One of the ones we looked at was in the context of eggs. Egg donation. People say, oh, commodification is evil. And then we say, well, you know, explain to me how in this context it's evil. And they immediately go to empirically testable harms. Right? It'd be one thing if they didn't go to that direction, but they immediately go there. And they say it causes exploitation, etc. And we can test those things and say it doesn't cause those things. So if that's, you know, if there's something outside of that kind of an empirically testable harm associated with commodification, then we can have that kind of conceptual argument. But I don't know what they are. They just throw the term commodification out as an argument stopper. And you hear that all the time. The Supreme Court of Canada did that recently. It's an argument stopper. Like often they do that with dignity, too. They throw the idea. It's infringement of dignity. Well, explain how it's an infringement of dignity.
Well, it's interesting that you should come to the commodification, because that's the very point that interested me about this eggs business. Because, I mean, for instance, in Canada, we have a free, you can donate blood, you don't buy blood. So, and people seem to feel good about that. But going to the commodification, is it not the case that if, and this is an argument that, in my opinion, of course, selling eggs is commodification, but the argument related to it is not just empirical. First of all, you know, when you gave evidence, there's this anthropologist who does these surveys about, you know, do people feel exploited? Well, really, I mean, I'm not surprised by that because, of course, we live in a society that's rampant with market arguments. So that being the case, most people have accepted them. So, you know, what's the big deal? That's the first point. My second point is that if you look at, for instance, you know, your liberal democracy, you have a, you know, Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the Alberta Bill of Rights, blah, blah, blah. Now, those things are only given, those rights are only ascribed or given to human beings. In other words, humans have them, you know, dogs, cats don't. And therefore, we have said that certain kinds of beings, i.e. humans, have those rights. I mean, that's basically, you know, and so therefore, is it not commodifying when you are sort of, connecting the humanist, the egg is going to become a human? So is it not an argument that entities that are going to have these rights ought not to be somehow compromised, and I don't know the argument, by sort of being brought into being by selling and buying?
A wonderful articulation of one of the sort of slippery slope commodification argument, right? And we see that with organs too, right? The idea is that we should not bring the market into this sphere, because if we do, we'll become more comfortable with the idea of commodifying whole humans, right? And therefore, we shouldn't have the market in this realm. I'm sympathetic to that argument, and I think that's a. I just don't see it. At some level, you have to say, show me how that plays out, right? Show me, because we do allow buying and selling of certain things. there's no evidence that there's a connection between those two things. Now people say, oh, Caulfield, you're so caught up in evidence, we're going to, you know, there's... I'm sensitive to that as a possible argument, but I just don't see any evidence that it plays out in that way in any kind of tangible manner. You know, this idea that if we allow the selling of our eggs, we're going to start treating humans like crap, basically, not respecting the dignity of humans. And that, to be honest, in short form, is what the commodification outside of these empirical harms is about, right? I think it's absolutely worth being sensitive to those issues, but I don't know how it's going to play out. But you did raise another interesting point, and it goes to, like, if you're going to take an empirical analysis of this, and this is true with selling of organs, too. It's not straightforward. You start allowing the selling of eggs, the altruistic donation of eggs goes down, right? So it's a complicated story. You start allowing the selling of organs, the altruistic donation of organs goes down. You know what I mean? So it's not like we're going to institute this and fix everything. It's a really complicated situation, you know, because we do erode the altruistic motivations behind it.
What's the legal status of the egg after it has been made use of, and after the person comes into the world, and then the so-called donor, and this is also, of course, a case for sperm. I mean, we're developing a little case law around this stuff, aren't we?
So, are you asking what is the legal status of, you know, believe it or not, it's unsettled.
Why not?
But, you know, I say believe it or not, because you think there's been so many cases, and there's been cases from the family law perspective, there's been cases from the property perspective, there's been cases from the consent law perspective. In other words, who controls the egg? What is the actual legal status of the egg? Is it a piece of property? Is it something else? Believe it or not, that's unsettled law, right? And generally what the courts do is they treat it as the legal entity that justifies the conclusion they're trying to get to. So if somehow a property characterization is going to help them get to the conclusion they want to get to, in this case, it's property, right? Sperm's property for a will, and you can do what you want in your will with your property, therefore it's property. In another situation, it's not property. So, for example, the courts are very hesitant to force a child to come into being. So if you donate a sperm for a woman to use, and then you break up or something, and then you say, I want that sperm to be destroyed, the woman says, no, I want to use that sperm, you gave it to me as a gift, the court will generally say, look, we're destroying the sperm, right? Because we're not going to have a child created for those. So it's been called sui generis, which is a wimpy legal term meaning, you know, many different things depending on the context. But incredible amount of interesting case law in this area.
If you take a quotation from many, many years ago by Carlyle, which is that cash payment is not the sole nexus of man to man. Presumably man to woman, woman to child, man to child. But if we reverse that and say cash payment is the sole nexus, would that help us in all these discussions? It seems to me it would.
In what way? By forcing us to?
I'm not recommending it. I'm saying it would, in the sense that we would say, well, we're doing it for the cash.
Yeah.
I don't think I want that society. I'm not saying that. But by taking it that way, maybe it makes it, puts it in its place.
Well, it forces us to consider what a society like that would be like.
Yes.
Carlyle. That's wonderful. Anyone else?
Since the bag is open and Latin expressions are coming out, in my head's been this one all evening or afternoon, Quo Vadis Dominus. In other words, where are we? Oh, Lord, where are we going? Especially in terms of all the science fiction implications of all this stuff. It just makes me want to live at least another 50 years, see what's going on. But also, regarding...
You might be able to.
Yeah, who knows? Kurzweil is working on that, isn't he? With all those... in terms of that expression, I'm especially thinking of next Tuesday, because if Mr. Romney, by hook or by crook, has his way with us, I have an American passport, so I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to start down the slippery slope, even though he says he's against women's rights and abortions. But you watch, give him 4 years, and a lot of wicked things, God help us all, might happen. Let's all pray.
So, you're all satisfied, comfortable, at ease. Your minds are settled. So thank you so much, Tim.
Well, I would like to thank the group. I mean, I just absolutely love this kind of exchange. What a rich discussion. It's, you know, it's been an honor to have this opportunity. So thank you very, very much.
We have a person in our midst who has reached a new day, a birthday. And since she is named for the bear, Ursula, perhaps some of you would like to sing for her.
I'm going to move away from the microphone.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Ursula. Happy birthday to you.
Now, it is customary. It is customary in Scandinavia, when this is done, for you actually to reflect on your life and give us a word.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for singing that song for me. And my birthday is actually, I'm 3/4 century old, and I think it's been wonderful and rather interesting to reflect on it, but I'd rather look ahead and see what else I can do in this lifetime.
Two weeks from today, we are going to think together about... Is that the last one?
Yep.
We're going to think together about the enormous matter of optimism, or is it control? What do we call it?
Choosing death is the title.
Choosing death. For all of you who like to be pro-choice, choosing death. Here's your chance. So we look forward to that.